The trick is, and I think Barack Obama has this trick, frankly, better than anybody else that I've seen in public office, to consistently support what is right, to consistently support the American people, to condemn terrorists when it occurs abroad and at home, torture when it occurs abroad and at home. You can condemn Al-Qaeda and George Bush, and you can still be a patriotic American. We need this kind of truth-telling in our politicians. And I still think Barack Obama will pull it out, become our nominee, as someone who uniquely can stand up for not just one kind of American, but for us all. Hope you enjoyed today's show. I will see you next week. For now, this is Mark Levine signing off.
Conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Good evening, Mr. Kincaid. Computers are fickle things. Sometimes difficult to get along with. Tonight, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to get through 7 more hours of live broadcasting without bumping the on-air PC. Failure to not bump the PC, Mr. Kincaid, will result in the video card getting all hinky and probably taking you off the air. Good luck, Mr. Kincaid. The PC upon which this message was recorded will self-destruct in 5 seconds. Yeah, that's why we were a little bit late starting Mark's program, and I apologize to Mark for that. Good evening, everyone. It's Thursday. Glad that at least that's what it is while we're doing this live, what it is while you're listening to it at your own choosing, because the internet is a very, very free place. Well, that's something entirely different. But we started having problems last night during my show, and then it carried over into Peter's show. So we did it sounds so highly technical and competent when Peter says it. We did a maintenance cycle, and things were okay after that, but Peter applied massive skull sweat to the problem, and after some conversating this morning, we determined that it was probably the video card. So we, the whole thing, like I said, you know, the pharmacist mate third class trying to do the appendectomy on the deck of the heaving ship, and Peter being the master physician back on shore, pull the video card, put a new video card in. But, you know, no problem is immediately solved. What happens when you solve a problem is that you discover and or create new problems. In this particular instance, the new problem being that the video card that I happened to have sitting around in a box that had never been used had two DVI outs that you had to use the little adapter to create a VGA connection. But the adapters are kind of heavy, and they put a strain on the card no matter how tightly you screw the little thumb screws in. And so I discovered, because I inadvertently bumped the PC right before Mark's show started, that it causes the video card to lose connection to the monitor, which then makes everything just go south. And so that's why Mark was late getting started, and that's why I am as nervous as a hooker in church for the next 7 hours as I try to get through that without bumping the PC and taking either myself or Peter, who has a fabulous guest tonight, or the horn section, or John off the air. So if I seem a little addled, it's because I'm kind of sitting here edging away from the PC to make sure my big old stupid knees don't bang into it because the PC's down on the floor. You get the idea. So I'm going to try not to be addled. I'm going to try not to be, otherwise prepossessed. Prepossessed? Is that not, that's not the right word. Not by any stretch of the imagination. But you get the idea. And heaven knows, there is no dearth of stuff to go through this evening. I have to get this one off my chest pretty quick, because I got this in from our pal Cindy in the Great Northwest, and it just kind of makes me a lot of sick. Apparently, Antonin, a religiously insane freak, member of Opus Dei, Scalia. Remember the saint who founded Opus Dei is quoted as having once said Hitler was unfairly treated by the world, that he couldn't possibly have killed 6 million Jews. It couldn't have been more than 4 million. Yeah, that. Antonin Scalia is a follower of that homicidal freak. And so he shows up on 60 Minutes this coming Sunday. Yeah, I know, carrying water for CBS. Somebody shoot me. But this deserves mentioning, because it's so very hateful. Leslie Stahl asks Fat Tony the Writ Scalia. Remember that line from Blazing Saddles? No, not Blazing Saddles, from True Grit? Mr. Rat, this is a rat writ writ for a rat, and this is lawful service of the same. And he puts a 50 caliber hole through the corner of his Mr. Singh's shanty or whatever, shooting a rat. Oh. Fat Tony the Rit Rat Scalia. In response to Leslie Stahl's question about Bush v. Gore. Oh, shoot. Just hear it for yourself. Okay, we've got to have a stupid ad in front of the video, but I got this right before the program started, and it really is under my skin, so I didn't just pre-record it. Bad on my part. But suffice to say that Scalia's response to a question about Bush versus Gore, get over it. Get over it. Here we go.
Of all the cases that have come before him on the court, Bush v. Gore may have been the most controversial. It has been reported that he played a pivotal role in urging the other justices to end the Florida recount, thereby handing the 2000 election to George Bush.
I and my court owe no apology whatever for Bush versus Gore. We did the right thing, so there.
People say that that decision was not based on judicial philosophy, but on politics.
I say nonsense.
Was it political?
Gee, I really don't want to get in. I mean, this is, get over it. It's so old by now.
The very essence of our republic was perverted and raped by that fat freak. And his response is to tell you and to tell me, get over it. It's like having a murderer walking the street. And you happen to see him and you say, why did you kill my baby? And he says, that was so long ago. Why don't you get over it? God Almighty, and this man is going to continue to sit on the Supreme Court of the United States for as long as there is life left in his filthy, gelatinous body. Gives me the fantods. Kind of wish Mark Levin was around. I'd like to get him in on this and get the serious legal analysis from him in regard to this kind of conduct. Because if you remember, or if I remember even, if I remember correctly, Bush v. Gore states clearly that that case was a one-off. There is language in Bush v. Gore that says Bush versus Gore and the decision therein and the holdings therein are never to be used as any form of precedent in any future case. I'm pretty sure I've got that right. Let's check in. I conjured him. Yay me. Hey, Mark.
Hello. You rang?
Yeah.
You asked for my legal analysis?
Yes, I conjured.
You conjured up, and lo and behold,
I've got a little cauldron here. It's bubbling away. I did the Levin chant. I turned the mic down.
Particularly on my favorite topic, my single favorite topic, the one that got me into Washington to begin with and leaving a lucrative career, by the way, I used to have as a trial lawyer. It was all because of Bush v. Gore.
Yeah, and you left it for all this.
Yeah, just the glamour that is the horn. Yes, to become an elitist like yourself.
Right. But hey, you know what? We may have a new marketing strategy. Bob Kincaid, hillbilly elitist.
I like it.
That means, well, I smoke a better grade of corncob pipe.
I suppose that's true. There's a bit of a delay between the time you speak and between the time it comes out. So I missed whatever little analysis you were making on Bush v. Gore.
Well, no, the only thing I pointed out, Mark, is that if I recall correctly, there is language inside the case that says that Bush versus Gore, and I say this because Scalia makes a point of rock solid analysis. my court did the right thing, so there. But isn't there language inside Bush versus Gore that says nothing in this case, no holding, no dictum, no nothing, should ever, 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 pinky swear, be used as precedent for any, or stare decisis for any future case, right?
That's correct. I will actually read to you the quote.
Okay.
Want?
Yes, please.
This quote, our consideration is limited to the present circumstances, as the problem of equal protection in election processes generally presents many complexities. They don't define what those complexities are.
Might have been nice to know what the complexities were, you know.
But they want to make clear that the consideration is limited. In other words, it only happens when you have, say, a Democrat losing to a Republican, and if you count all the votes, the Democrat would win. That might be one of those complexities.
There's the complexity. Yeah, that's complex.
You know, when I first wrote on this issue, the title, which was changed by others, Michael Moore changed it to A Layman's Guide to Bush v. Gore. But my original title was The Gore Exception to the Rule of Law.
See, I like that better.
The court had set up a Gore exception. In other words, we will follow the law except when Al Gore is running for president and is voted in by the American people, in which case there has to be a Gore exception.
You know, I remember way back when I was in college and going to Mountaineer football games every Saturday, Mark, and trust me, I'm going to make a point out of this.
I'm waiting.
It seemed like if the Mounties went and played somewhere else, whosoever stadium we were playing in, they got home cooking from the referee squad there.
Yep.
But when we came and played at home, we couldn't get any home cooking from the referees. Because the flags
don't you
kept
hate
going.
It when your own team is fair and the other team isn't.
Yeah,
it's so annoying.
But I called it the stupid hillbilly rule. You know, the ref would throw the yellow hanky, blow the whistle, and say, "You're a bunch of dumbass hillbillies, 15 yards." You know.
Well, but this is actually related to the point that I was making on my show just before yours, which is we've gotten to the point where the Republicans are being so lawless and so outside the law, whether it be torture or wiretapping or anything like that, that the Democrats are afraid to act within their rights under the law. It's like your refs, right?
Yeah.
You're home cooked when you play abroad, when you play in Visitor's Field, and then your own refs, they want to be fair. It's like Congressman Bart Sestak.
Oh, he drove me crazy the other day, Mark. He drove me crazy.
Well, but you had to hear what he had to say. That's why I brought him on. He drove me crazy, too. I tried to be very polite. I tried to be very gentle with him, but I was saying, in effect, you coward, why don't you use your power? And he was saying, well, you know, it would look bad.
Yeah, I would never do this to you, but I could have popped in with a smart-ass voiceover and said, shh, be very quiet. We're in the bush. Look over there. It's a spineless weenie crat. Don't make any sudden moves or any loud noises. They're very timid and prone to running away.
Yes, they are.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's fear of the public relations battle. Instead of saying we want to uphold the Constitution and damn it, we'll defend it. We'll come on TV and we're going to say to the American people, hey. We have a right to find out what they're doing. We have the right to know what they're spying on you. So, yes, we're using our rights to hold them until they talk. And these have been used for 200 years. Instead of making the argument, it's like, well, they might take it the wrong way. And the sad thing is that the one time that the Democrats did hold true, and I'm still proud of them for this, which was on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, when Nancy Pelosi, so far, hasn't caved. The Senate has caved, but she refuses to cave in on the point of retroactive immunity. And Republicans said, there's going to be a disaster, there's going to be a terrorist attack, they're going to all come kill us all, and they raised the rhetoric to a fever pitch, and the American people yawned. And the Democrats were so worried. I can't tell you how many people said to me before this happened in private conversations, Mark, we don't dare do this. They're gonna call. They're going to say there's going to be a terrorist attack. Americans are going to take it out against the Democrats. And lo and behold, what happened? Nancy Pelosi did stand firm. They did say there's going to be this huge terrorist attack, and there wasn't one. And the American people yawned, and people said, oh, that's just George Bush, you know, foaming at the mouth. And America moved on, and we still don't have the bill that George Bush insisted was absolutely necessary to save American lives.
And you know, the RPGs still haven't let go of that, Mark. Just a couple of days ago, I noticed where Dick Cheney was out speaking or shooting somebody in the face or something, and he said, this is where the rhetoric has gone. He said, well, the Democrats in the Congress have allowed FISA to expire. No, really, he said that.
Which, of course, isn't true.
No, it's not only not true, it's a great, big, broad, wide lie that you could drive a semi-tractor trailer through sideways.
That is true.
FISA hasn't expired.
No, it hasn't.
The Protect America Act expired.
The one that allows no oversight and widespread.
Yeah, the one that had a built-in sunset to it, to, you know, because you do that with legislation sometimes when you're not sure if it's really necessary or is going to be effective. The sucker sunsets, and then, you know, if you don't need it, you don't do it. You don't renew it.
But with sunset specifically, because the Bush administration did another one of these. If you don't do this right now, we're all going to be attacked. We're all going to die. And so the Democrats said, fine, we'll give it, you say it's absolutely necessary, we'll give it to you for 6 months while we see if it's absolutely necessary. Turns out it wasn't, and they let it expire. But here's my point, and it's not just to find the one small act of bravery the Democrats have done and praise it. it's to let the Democrats know that look what happened. You were brave, you stood up to the president, and the roof didn't cave in. I mean, true, not that many people noticed, you know, one way or the other. But that's okay, too. The roof didn't cave in. See, they're afraid if they take poor Harriet Myers and stick her in an office, in a cushy office with food, and hold her there until she speaks, that, oh, my God, the Democrats are imprisoning a woman. You know, here, the Republicans are torturing innocent people, sending poor
Harriet
to be beaten with cables, and they're afraid that they're going to hold Harriet Myers in a cushy office until she tells us what she knows?
See, I'm a jackass that way, Mark. I want them to hold her in a cushy office and waterboard her while she's there.
We don't do that, Bob.
But it's not torture.
Yeah, well, true, according to the Republicans.
Right. Well, let me back up for just a minute, and I mean let's have a little analysis on this, although we've run rather far afield from filthy fat Tony Scalia, and I want to come back to him. You talk about, you know, the Democrats are afraid that, you know, they'll be pilloried in the press as, you know, not protecting America.
Right. And they are legitimate. I mean, they are afraid.
And that's what I was going to get to. They have a legitimate beef there because it doesn't matter which alphabet soup network you're talking about. The Democrats cannot get a fair shake in the American media. You know, the genius flowing from the Powell memo forward, the genius of standing out on the American street corner and howling liberal bias every minute of every day for three decades, to the point that, you know, you've convinced some of the American people, but most importantly, you've convinced the purveyors of information themselves.
That's right.
So that everything they write, everything they print, everything they say, everything that is broadcast over television or radio, they sort of gatekeeper themselves and self-censor to see.
Yeah.
I wonder if I'm being liberal if I say this.
Look at the fact that they're trying to get a poor man who was once on welfare and the child of a single mother, and they're calling him an elitist because he hasn't bowled before. I mean, look at this.
I get really believing it, Bob.
I would just laugh at it. The people are believing.
Well, you probably missed my little monologue the other night about the girl at the grocery store, 20 years old, who said, "I'll never vote for him. I don't want no towel head for my president."
Oh no! Is that in your grocery store?
Yeah, just up the road from here.
What did you say to her?
I just looked at her. I just looked at her and said, "You're kidding, right?" Yeah. Well, no. I said, he was born in the United States. John McCain wasn't.
Right. Born in Panama.
And he said, and so she, you know, I challenged her on that, and she backs up and says, well, his mama was an atheist.
Well, that's true, actually.
Well, yes, it is. And I looked at her and said, so were Jefferson, Washington, and Franklin. How did that work out?
Good response.
It is. It's maddening. It is absolutely maddening. And it doesn't help. I swore I would never mention this kind of crap on the air again, but I'm going to break my own vow. It doesn't help when the folks supporting Barack Obama, ostensibly, say that the people who voted for Hillary Clinton in Pennsylvania are white trash.
Yes, that doesn't help.
It does not help. Because, see, we need those people who voted for Hillary in Pennsylvania to vote for Barack Obama against John McCain.
Yes, we do. Badly. And that's
because I'm really sick of moral victories. Because moral victories aren't victories.
No, they're called defeats in other terms.
Yeah, it is. It's called losing, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, here we are, 8 years removed from Bush v. Gore, and we know that they dummied up the court case. We know that we know about Choice Point, and we know about the data mining, and we know about the cage list, and we know about the felon purge list, and we know for a fact that if in fact all the votes had been counted, we would have been talking about President Gore all this time. And this monster from the Supreme Court says, "Get over it."
Well, what else is he going to say? She asked him if it was done for political reasons. The answer, of course, is only yes.
Yes.
And not only that, but conservative legal analysts, conservative professors in law school also can't help but admit it was done for political reasons.
Jonathan Turley is no raging liberal.
No.
And who's that other, the really squirrely...
Mitch McConnell, the judge of Utah who's so right-wing... that the Democrats actually filibustered him, also conceded that Bush v. Gore has no basis in law. The amazing thing about it, since I wrote that piece that brought me to Washington and changed my life and all of that, I have never found a single legal scholar in the entire world, that's this planet, I haven't looked on other planets,
yeah. Damn
who
you.
Defend the logic of Bush v. Gore. I'm going to repeat that. There is not a single legal scholar in the entire world, that would be the United States and all other countries, who has ever defended the legal logic of Bush v. Gore. You can take John Yoo, a man who can try to justify torture, and he can't defend the logic of a case that is internally inconsistent, a case that says 2 plus 2 equals 5. A case that says, in the very same opinion, there shall not be a time limit for democracy on the same opinion where it sets a time limit for democracy.
Oh, I know. I so desperately want to hook John Yoo up to a couple of jumper cables and put one, you know, and connect one pole of a diehard to him and say, you got 60 seconds. If I hook up the other pole, John, is it going to be torture?
Yeah, that would be nice. And that would actually be one of the few cases of justified torture.
It would be,
well, I need to let you go and do your show.
Yeah, you got to get out of here. But I appreciate you popping in because this is
you conjured me. What could I?
You're right. You know, you had no choice.
You did the cauldron, and I had to show.
Poof.
But I'll go now.
All right. Bye, Mark.
Bye, Bob.
Official Horn legal analyst Mark Levine. You heard it from him. It's a con. It's a dummied-up job. It's a fix. And, of course, in the rest of the interview, he blames Al Gore for throwing it to the courts. Then why was it Bush versus Gore? Why wasn't it Gore versus Bush? Oh, we won't bother with those inconvenient truths now, will we? And you look at that picture of Scalia, and you know, and this is the kind of thing that makes it hard for dinner to stay down, and you know that you're looking at the son of the president of the American Fascist Party. You're looking at the son of a man who openly endorsed and supported Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini. And he wields life or death power over the people of the United States. And you just shake your head and you wonder how a goon like that ever was allowed onto the Supreme Court by a subservient Senate. So that's where we can start. And it's a decent starting place. How about it? You willing to get over it? Are you over it? I'm never going to be over it. I don't think I'm ever going to be over it. If I make it to some ripe old age, maybe old enough to have great-grandchildren, they'll be crawling around on the floor, and I'll be going on, you know, in my sort of toothless old way.
Pay attention, kids. Back in 2000, those godless, soulless, motherless Republicans stole our government from us. In Bush versus Gore.
Yeah. Because why? Because it's true. And because something like watching your very right to vote be stolen from you, because it's not just people in Florida who got their right to vote stolen. It was everybody in the United States who, in a majority, voted for Al Gore who had their vote stolen. And I feel like a victim of a crime. Mainly because I am a victim of a crime. Oh, God, this CBS text just...
Call him conservative, just don't call him biased on issues before the Supreme Court, including abortion. He says,
I'm a law and order kind of guy. I mean, I confess to being a social conservative, but it does not affect my views on cases. On the abortion thing, for example, if indeed I were trying to impose my own views, I would not only be opposed to Roe versus Wade, I would be in favor of the opposite view, which the anti-abortion people would like to see adopted, which is to interpret the Constitution to mean that a state must prohibit abortion.
No, see, that's called setting up a straw man. No, it's enough that he said time after time that given the opportunity, he'd overturn Roe versus Wade. This is also a man who said that no human being, no citizen, never mind human being, we know what he thinks of human beings who aren't American, but he has repeatedly said that no citizen of this United States has a constitutional right not to be executed when he's innocent. Hear it again. You, as a citizen of the United States, in the weird medieval view of Fat Tony Scalia, do not have a constitutional right not to be executed if you are innocent of the crime with which you are charged. In the sick, twisted, brown-shirted, jack-booted, fascist world of Fat Tony Scalia, you can be charged with a crime, convicted of a crime, and be executed for that crime, and be innocent, and it's all no harm, no foul. You got it? And he'll sit there until his dying day, spewing his fascist filth and his hate and his bigotry and his religious intolerance
all the while sitting there whipping himself because he's a member of Opus Dei. And anybody with any sort of regard for the Constitution whose gorge doesn't rise at the very mention of Fat Tony Scalia's name, well, there's something profoundly wrong. We'll go to the phones.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Juanita.
Oh, boy, you said the secret words, didn't you?
Which ones?
Scalia.
I hate him. Okay,
person from Florida. You know what? They said, get over it back when it was fresh and new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when the bloodstains were still fresh on the concrete, right? Yeah,
it's putrid and old now, and don't tell me to get over it. That El Jerko.
You're a victim of a crime. Since when are victims of crime in America supposed to get over it?
Right, and I think it constitutes murder and everything else. So there's no statute of limitation on murder.
Nope.
His allowed the murderous.
You know, way back when, during the Lincoln presidency, Abraham Lincoln considered throwing Chief Justice Roger Taney of the Supreme Court in irons and putting him in prison indefinitely without recourse to habeas corpus.
Uh-huh.
Sort of like what George Bush does now.
Yes.
And I used to read that and think, you know, that really shows Lincoln's bent toward totalitarianism. And it did. But you know what? When you look at somebody as poisonous and hateful and disgusting and un-American as Antonin Scalia,
yeah,
it would not bother me in the least to see him thrown in a hole and the key thrown away.
Yep. And, you know, there's just so much to be said for all of it. You know, it's just, you just couldn't stop if you got the going on it. You know what I'm saying? It's just...
Oh, Antonin, I'll tell you freely, Antonin Scalia is one of those guys that the thoughts I think, and then I think they can't get me for thinking yet.
Right. I know I've been thinking a lot of stuff, too, believe me. They say it all the time, you know, get over it, get over it. I mean, they constantly said it then, and, you know, I mean,
they tell us to get over it, but then by extension, Henry Hyde of Illinois admitted that the impeachment of Bill Clinton was payback for Nixon. And we're the ones who need to get over it. Those are the people with the get over it problem.
Well, but they think
because Nixon was actually a criminal.
Don't you know things are different for them? You know that, Bob.
Jesus, yeah,
it's
I guess.
When you're them, you know.
I know.
And you know.
Makes me a little crazy.
I know it. When you started talking about that, I thought, "Oh my kingdom," because I hadn't heard that one. That was a new one.
Yeah, get over it.
And anything he does. Oh, I know what I wanted to ask you. Have you ever watched the show Boston Legal?
I got to tell you, I haven't. I watch approximately 1 hour of television per week.
Well, it's amazing. You know, it's an amazing show, and the one guy is very liberal on there. You know, the one lawyer. It's about a law office, and. He got to argue a case before the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
and they had the different people playing the different justices, which was really interesting. And he started out trying to be prim and proper and all, but they got his dander up, you know, and he started talking back to him, and he just brought up a whole bunch of that stuff, including 2000. And... It was really good. If you ever get a chance, I think you'll fall for that show.
I'm scared to death that I might.
Yeah, it is really good. And of course, William Shatner plays the right winger.
Oh, I caught. You know, I think I caught a YouTube clip or something one time of that show,
where he and James Spader was defending him against a toe-tapping case in a public restroom?
Oh, yeah. That's a fairly recent one. Yeah. The guy that wrote, he's married to Michelle Pfeiffer, I forget his name, that writes the show. He's a genius. He really is a genius. It's really an amazing show. But that was interesting that this week they had him arguing before the Supreme Court for he was arguing against putting a young man to death that was mentally challenged, and he'd raped a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
That was what he was. He kept saying he didn't do it. But they were going to, you know, put him to sleep. Of course, I don't know what, you know, they decided, but anyway. And I heard you start calling yourself a hillbilly elitist.
Yeah, I like that, don't you?
I do, too.
Bob Kincaid, hillbilly elitist.
I don't know if you remember. Maybe they changed it before you were born. I don't know. But do you know anything about when country western used to be hillbilly music?
Yeah, oh, yeah, sure.
That's all it was hillbilly, but then they got prim and proper and changed it to country western.
Yeah. That's exactly what it was. And I don't think our resident expert on that sort of thing is available to us tonight, but that's what it was when the Opry started.
Oh yeah. It's been when I was growing up, and when I was little, we had a radio, and every Saturday night that radio was on to WCKY, Cincinnati, Ohio. And you hear the Duke of Paducah and Roy Acuff and all those people. And my parents would go to sleep with it on. That was one of my favorite nights of the year. I could get to listen to the radio real loud.
Oh.
There were the
scads of shows. There was a Louisiana Hayride out of Shreveport. And what was the show that was out of Wheeling, West Virginia, and then the Opry on WSM, and it spoke to rural America in a way that perhaps Bing Crosby and folks like that didn't.
Right.
And I love it. I just love it.
Anyway.
But you know, if we had folks. You know, who did voicers and liners, and we did all of that fancy schmancy stuff that they like to do on terrestrial radio, and you know, maybe we'll get back to a little bit of it at some point. We'd have a liner that says he's a hillbilly elitist with a better grade of corn cob pipe. It's Bob Kincaid.
Well, that's what I'm gonna call you. I'm gonna call you a hillbilly elitist.
All right, I hope it sticks. I like that. I like that a lot.
Too.
Sometimes I come up with
hillbilly
a dandy one thing.
Hillbilly elitist.
Exactly.
Right.
Hey, Juanita, you have a good night.
In Alabama and now in West Virginia.
Exactly. got his heels in the hills.
Yes. Good night, you old hillbilly elitist.
Hey, good night, Juanita.
Good night.
Bye now. Oh, I think we have a winner. Hillbilly elitist. I like that a lot. Hey, welcome.
Hey there, you hillbilly elitist.
Well, hey, Susan. Don't we just love that?
Yep. I just put a post up on the main blog. People should read it.
Okay.
It's called Groundbreaking New Book Documents Widespread Election Fraud.
Which book is that?
It is a book by Mark Crispin Miller and Brad Friedman.
Ah.
It is called Loser Take All.
That Brad, he gets around.
Yep. So, it's...
We haven't babbled Brad and I in a while. I think I need to set up a babble with him soon.
Yeah. It's worthwhile to read the article because it wasn't just 2001 that got stolen. 2004 got ripped off real good.
So did 2002. See, I've got a book here by Stephen Freeman and Joel Blythus who are real live, honest to God, PhD, highbrow professors and stuff. And it's called, Was the 2004 Presidential Election Stolen? And the answer is, yes, 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 it was.
Yep.
My God, this thing has, oh, let me just check here and do a little bit of quick math. It'll only take me a second, I promise. Let's see, notes begins on. It's got something like 75 pages of documented footnotes. And he's been on the program. I interviewed him in D.C., and yeah, it's all a ripoff. It's all a fraud. And for Scalia, and Scalia laughs all the way to the bank.
According to this op-ed, they're already working to steal the 2008 election, among other things. And the both the Clinton and Obama campaign should be putting things in place so that whoever wins the nomination, among other things, the VA is no longer going to make any effort to help wounded soldiers vote.
Jesus, criminy.
Supporting the troops.
So
if I were the Obama campaign, I would be showing up down there with vans going into the hospitals saying, guys, you're going to be in here for a while. We need to change your registration. Time to do it now so that you will be able to vote. We'll be back in November to take you down to the polling place because the federal government isn't going to do it.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, the Dems should be doing this.
I hate to sound maudlin, and that is not my intent, Susan. But it's stuff like this that makes me really, really miss my dad. Because I really enjoyed finding stories like this and going in and telling dad sitting in the chair, you're not going to believe this, and then just listening to dad go off. I mean, I come by some of this honest, okay?
Oh, yeah.
Because he was so disgusted and so saddened and so infuriated because he ask Donald, he's got the same
experience, the same way.
They felt like they had beaten back, they felt like they had protected America forever from outside fascist domination, and I guess they had, but I'll be diddly damned if we didn't get our own homegrown brand of fascism that apparently there's nothing anybody can do about.
Yeah, and my husband's quite a bit older than I am, so he fought in World War II, and he says that all the time. Why did I slog through the Pacific? Why?
Yeah, I remember when Dad looked at me and said, why did my big brother die? So George Bush could wind up president?
Why did I have a heart attack in Korea? For this?
Yeah. Lest we get too depressing, we'll kind of leave it at that. How the hell are you supposed to get over the burglar, the mugger, looking you in the eye and telling you that you're wrong because you resent having your vote stolen? Because, see, maybe we've gotten a little too far away from it, Susan, and there's been so much data and so much evidence that we don't quite know how to cast what happened in Bush v. Gore. Was it Bush v. Gore? They stopped the recant. Bush v. Gore. They ignored the cage list.
They sanctified the felon
purge list. Blah, blah, blah. No, they stole the vote of the entire majority of Americans who voted for Al Gore.
Yeah.
We can talk about election fraud. We can talk about touchscreen machines and butterfly ballots and chads and chodes and so forth. They stole the damned votes from you and from me. I remember
that's
that.
I mentioned this post because they're getting ready to do it again.
Yeah, they are. Look, through this primary process, it's probably happening now. I read a post from Brad Friedman that suggested that the other night, referring to Hillary Clinton as the luckiest woman in America.
Yeah, that's why we're saying turn out, turn out, turn out, turn out. Don't you dare stay home.
We had just moved over here at the time of the 2000 election, and our voter registrations were still in the other county. And I remember my wife and I piling the babies, who were still little bitty, into the car and driving 90 miles over winding roads to cast our votes for Al Gore.
Yeah.
And then 90 miles home in the dark. And all of that, that devotion, that dedication, that determination, that patriotism was shat on and spat on and ground beneath the ugly jackboots of people like Antonin Scalia, and I will hate him till the day I die for it.
Well, about dear old Mr. Scalia, yeah, he's technically there till the day he dies or is impeached.
Don't even think about it. If we can't get the Congress to enforce its own damned inherent powers of subpoena, don't even think about impeaching Scalia.
For that, we're going to have to get people in there with backbones. If we do that,
Mark Levine, by the way, says if you're looking for a quick, call it what it is. He says call it a coup d'état.
Exactly, a coup d'état.
And you know what? You can't call it a bloodless coup either. That's a phrase people say. It was a bloodless coup in the Central African. Blah, 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 blah.
All those soldiers who bled.
Yeah, yeah. Tell it to the 4,000 plus dead American soldiers, and tell it to the million dead Iraqis.
Iraqis, yeah. Bloodless, my foot. But Reed's got to go. Pelosi's got to go. The Dinos have to go. And then, and only then, can we take back the Supreme Court. By impeachment, if necessary. And having Antonin Scalia be probably the first, I think he would be the first justice of the Supreme Court to be impeached and tossed out on his back herein would tickle me death.
I'm really liking the Lincoln solution a lot better. Lock him up, throw away the key. Without habeas corpus. Because, see, he himself has said that it's okay to lock up Americans without habeas corpus.
My problem with that is then you become them.
No, maybe then you start cleaning out them. What the hell? No, I'm sorry. We're only treating them under the terms of their own legal rulings.
Yeah.
They say waterboarding isn't torture, so I say waterboard Josh Bolton and Harriet Myers.
I have to admit that my biggest fantasy is that on January 20th of 2009, the President of the United States, using the Military Commissions Act, signs a detention order for the entire previous administration, has them shipped off to Gitmo until all of the hearings are done and all of the proof is assembled, and then the entire previous administration is shipped off along with the proof to The Hague with the message to the world court, here, try him. The United States hereby disavows any further relationship to these people. Do what you will. and then they repealed the Military Commissions Act. It's a nice fantasy, you have to admit.
Yeah, top notch, restaurant quality.
Hey, if you're gonna have, if you're gonna dream, dream good.
Yeah, dream big, dream big. And you know, speaking of waterboarding, there's another waterboarding story out there. I'll probably get to it in the next hour. In fact, I'm determined to get to it in the next hour. About dear old Crisco John unable to handle a question from a college student.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing.
Oh, yes. I saw it.
And so, yeah, there's more of that. It, yeah.
The man
is just... Susan, I'm going to run along. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah. Love to everybody.
All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Look, I don't pretend to be some sort of cool, even-handed, neutral, unbiased. Now, I'm not going to give you any of that stuff because everybody has bias. The multi-millionaire bonus babies of the news media, the Tweety Matthewses and the Timmy Russerts and Brian Williams and Britt Hume and who and Katie Couric and whoever's going to replace her and Charlie Gibson and they're all biased. Most of their biases run contrary to mine because I'm biased. My bias is for the Constitution of the United States. My bias is for the rule of law. Their bias is for the rule of corporations, because they do the corporation's bidding. I keep coming back and coming back. All my life, I listened to Me and Bobby McGee, that wonderful song. And it would come to that line, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. And as a young man, I don't think I got it. I don't think I understood it. But here now at the tender age of 45, I get it. I so get it. Because I sure as hell don't have any $5 million a year in a house on Nantucket like that waste of oxygen Chris Matthews. Don't know that I want it either, for the record. I'm freer than he is. I can actually talk about facts and talk about truth, while everything that comes out of his mouth has to at least be colorable as pleasing to his masters. Chris Matthews, Tim Russert, Brian Williams, the whole filthy crowd, they're slaves. I'm not. I'm free. You're free. We're free. Because freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. But I say that first, knocking wood, because we've all got plenty left to lose. Perhaps more correctly put, we've all got plenty left to have taken away from us. They've taken our votes. They've taken, in as far as the broadcast and the SOCA, they've taken the public airwaves away from us so that they're no longer public. They've taken away our right to be secure in our persons, papers, and effects. That story coming up as well. They've taken and taken and taken, but please understand, when it comes to repiglickins, there's no such word as enough. And as long as the people who work their asses off and carry America on their backs every day have so much as a scrap remaining, there will be a repiglickin' party out there that's looking to take it away. Because that's what repiglickins do. They're thieves.
their skulking footpad cut purses operating in the dim and still of the night. They can't operate in daylight, because if daylight ever hits them, the American people will see them for who they are, and the Republican Party will be dead forever. So they have to keep working in the shadows. They have to work in the corners. So that's our first hour. We'll take a little break. We'll come back. And yeah, Crisco John goes to Galesburg. Coming up. This is America's liberal voice. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Ocean's daughter walking on the way she came, staring as she called my name, and I can't get it out of my head. No, I can't get it out of my head. Now my
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Honest to God, I can't get it out of my head. We was robbed. The lady that stands in New York Harbor with the torch, she was robbed. The lady who stands in the entryway of the Department of Justice with the blindfold and the scales and the sword, she was robbed. Al Gore was robbed. But that's okay. That's okay, burglary victims. That's okay, mugging victims. That fat, rotten bastard who sits on the Supreme Court of the United States wants you to get over it. Get over it. He is, after all, a scion of fascism. And when fascism tells you to get over it, you'd best be getting over it. Don't you understand? I means for yous to get over it. God almighty. You know, I said something the other night about... I think it was in our conversation with our first-time caller, Greg, last night from Washington, talking about how inspiring it is to see, oh, God, I'm only 45. I'm not entitled to say the young people. It was only yesterday that I was the young people. But, yeah, but it is inspiring to see younger people getting active. I'm looking at a photograph of the steps into the hall where John Ashcroft spoke at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois, a few nights ago. Written in chalk on the steps leading into the building, these words: always question authority. Know your enemy. Know your rights. Fascism is not Knox. Ashcroft is a war criminal. Torture is evil. A banner hanging over the entryway, done in on a white background with blue and red letters, that says "Domestic Terrorist." One student chained with his head tilted and his head covered, lying prone on a board, waiting for the waterboarding that John Ashcroft says is downright murkin'. A row of students with their heads covered in black bags and their hands painted red as of blood. One of my best friends in the first college I attended was a transfer from Knox College, in Galesburg, Illinois. So I was, in some weird way, proud to see... proud to see Knox College students standing up to the fascists. Because that's what they are. They're not conservatives. That's the word they chose for themselves because they knew that fascist just wouldn't work. Knox College, being a small liberal arts college, has a pretty liberal student body. Their conservative students association has maybe 10 members. But those 10 members went up and rounded up the 15 large that it takes to bring Crisco John Ashcroft to your function, your event, to talk about leadership in difficult times. I'm sorry. The Knox College Republicans have only 6 members. So 15 divided by 6. Yeah, they raised a little in excess of $2,000 apiece to bring John Ashcroft to pollute that fine institution. Imagine that. 6 students have the ability to raise $15,000, and their first thought of what to do with it was to bring a disgraced former attorney general to their campus. Not to feed the hungry. Not to contribute it, say, to Habitat for Humanity. Not to perhaps buy much-needed supplies, furniture, small appliances, hardware, to help rebuild the Gulf Coast and New Orleans. Nope. Gonna give $15,000 to a millionaire, so he can come and tell us how patriotic it is to torture the brown ones. That's what he did. Prior to Ashcroft's appearance at Knox College, the dean of students had sent out an email warning students not to disrupt the speech. Nice. Nice there, Deany Weeny. So, the thing went down two nights ago. And John Ashcroft did not give his best performance. There's a tremendous account that I'm working from over at Daily Kos. I don't go there very often, but that's where this is, and it's profound. The young woman who wrote it apparently has a future in journalism, it would appear. By the way, like so many Midwestern liberal arts colleges, Knox College's students are quite liberal. The town, however, is decidedly conservative. One student was standing just below the video cameras wearing an orange jumpsuit, handcuffs, and a black hood. Stood through the entire speech and through the questions afterward. Another group of students had a sign said, "Hey John, how's it feel to lose to a dead guy?" The president of the Gang of Six, otherwise known as the Knox Republicans, introduced Crisco John, called him a man of great integrity, and got laughed at by the audience, who works hard to protect our freedoms and liberties. There was even more laughter. And then, who has tirelessly upheld our Constitution, and the laughter became like a wave. So, you know, Ashcroft gave some remarks, and the real fire and brimstone started in the question and answer session. Then he started mocking the students who were protesting him. When he got started, that row of students I described to you with the black hoods and the red hands raised their hands to him. And then finally, he was so pissed off, he said, "Somebody holding a gun on these students or something? What's this stuff on your hands? Is that supposed to mean something?" And one of the students said, "Blood." "Blood, huh?"
Seems these young folks think they have blood on their hands and want to show it off to everyone. Come on, take a good look at him.
They kept holding their hands up, and Ashcroft went on with his speech. At one point, the red-handed protesters stood up and put black hoods over their heads, and one of the townies said,
"Sit down, we can't see."
And Ashcroft said,
"Neither can they. They got bags on their heads."
Then he said,
"And while we're on the subject, I'd like to say a few things about these kids. They don't want to see. There are none so blind as those who refuse to see. They don't want to see."
"We've seen, John. We've seen you, war criminal. We've seen plenty." Fascinating comment. He was asked about the fact that he's a religious goonie. And he said,
"I would hope that if somebody accused me of being a Christian, there would be enough evidence to convict me. But nobody has the right to force their religious opinions on other people or to disrespect other people's faith."
And the writer, who in the Coast Diary is called El Sonora, said it was the only reasonable thing he said all night and got him a big round of applause. But I'd like to sort of revisit that if we could. Nobody has the right to force their religious opinions on other people or to disrespect other people's faith. I call BS. I really, really call BS on that. No one does have the right to force their religious beliefs on anyone else, but everyone has the absolute, untrammeled, unqualified right to be critical of the religious faith of another. Absolutely. Why in heaven's name do we keep repeating this stupid, stupid aphorism that says, "I have to respect the fact that you believe in invisible crap"? Do I really have to respect John Hagee when John Hagee says that God sent a hurricane to wipe out the homos? Do I really? Do I really have to respect Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson when he says that 9/11 was the fault of lesbians and liberals and people for the American way? Do I really gotta? Unless you make me, I ain't gonna. Now, I'll do my best to keep my tongue when you start talking about how someday Jesus is going to come down in the clouds and lift you up out of your Cadillac Escalade and fly you off into the clouds because you're such a good Extian. You know, I can sort of go, boop, and turn away. But does anybody actually think that I have to respect that insanity? Old Christian prayers, back before there was much in the way of an organized church, used to end with a phrase that came from much earlier Greek precedents. And that phrase is "world without end." World without end. Not "someday I'm going to fly up into the clouds while still wearing my brand spanking new outfit that was made in a sweatshop in China and I just got down to the Wally World." No. World without end. But that got replaced somewhere along the way by the Christian Dominionists and the Millennialists and the Premillennialists and the Postmillennialists and the Millennial Millennialists and the Manila Envelope Millennialists. And now it's not world without end. It's a world that's going to end when Jesus gets in his holy rolls and drives on down through the clouds. Oh, glory! Somebody asked John Ashcroft, how do you sleep at night? And he got pissed off again and said, only God can judge me. Well, no, John, actually, if we had any justice in this country, you could be judged by a panel of jurists and legal experts in a war crimes tribunal, just like was done with the Nazis and the thugs from the Empire of Japan, John. But seeing how there's no justice in the world anymore, nobody's going to judge you. Not formally. Millions of us in America have already judged you, John, and we find you wanting, old boy. We find you wanting in the common graces of humanity. We find you wanting in the essential dignity of a human being. We find you wanting in the compassion that was exhibited by that brown-skinned Nazarene carpenter that you profess to worship. We find you wanting, John Ashcroft, in ever so many things. We find you wanting in everything but essential monstrosity. Because you have a surfeit of that. Yes, you do. So that was the only thing he got applause on, and I don't know why. He finally, in the question and answer session, got queried on the fact that he sat in on meetings where it was determined that it would be okay to torture the brown people. Question. This story was made public by ABC a few weeks ago. It claims that you, Rice, Tenet, and others met in the White House to discuss different methods of enhanced interrogation. Is that correct? Ashcroft says, correct? Is what correct? Is it correct that this story ran on ABC? I don't know that. I don't know anything about it. Is it a real story? When was the story, huh? Huh? When? I know nothing. Early April? April 9th, I think. You think? You think? You don't even know. Next question! The article says that you discussed whether they would be slapped, pushed, deprived of sleep, or subjected to simulated drowning. I said next question! The next questioner asked him whether his position on torture violated the Geneva Conventions or other international laws, and this is just precious. No, it doesn't violate the Geneva Conventions. As for other laws, well, the U.S. is a party to the United Nations Convention Against Torture, and that convention, well, when we join a treaty like that, we send it to the Senate to be ratified, and when the Senate ratifies it, they often add qualifiers, reservations to the treaty, which affect exactly what we follow. Now, I don't have a copy of the convention in front of me. And Elsinora, the author of this diary, says, I do. Would you like to borrow it? Oh. And it's kind of like Ashcroft has sort of gotten a little poke in the chest. You keep a hold of it. Now, I was saying I don't have it with me, but I'm pretty sure it defines torture as something that leaves lasting scars or physical damage. A student from the audience yells, you liar! Liar! So, no, waterboarding does not violate international law. And that's when our diarist, Elsinora, stands up. And it is a piece of beautiful, beautiful work. As she says, first off, Mr. Ashcroft, I'd like to apologize for the rudeness of some of my fellow students. It was uncalled for.
We can disagree civilly. We don't need that. And there's applause from the audience, and Ashcroft beams down upon her. I have here in my hand two documents. One of them, you know, is the text of the United Nations Convention Against Torture, which, point of interest, says nothing about lasting physical damage.
Do you have the Senate reservations to it?
No, I don't. Do you happen to know what they are?
I don't have them memorized, no. I don't have time to go around memorizing random legal facts.
Wait a minute. He was the Attorney General of the United States. He doesn't have time to go around memorizing random legal facts. Let's see. A bequest must vest if it vests at all within 25 years of a life in being. How's that? That's the rule against perpetuities. Equity abhors a vacuum. There's one. All liability is based on fault. There's another one. But just random legal facts. And I'm not even the Attorney General of the United States. Hell, I'm not a lawyer.
But John Ashcroft cannot be bothered to remember random legal facts.
I just don't want these people in the audience to go away saying he was wrong. She had the proof right in his hand, in her hand. Because that's not true. It's a lie. You don't have the reservations. You don't have anything.
Now, if you want to bring them another time, we can talk, but... Well, actually, Mr. Ashcroft, my question was about this other document. This other document is a section from the judgment of the Tokyo War Tribunal. After World War II, the Tokyo Tribunal was basically the Nuremberg trials for Japan. Many Japanese leaders were put on trial for war crimes and crimes against humanity, including torture, and among the tortures listed was water treatment, which we nowadays call waterboarding.
This is a speech, not a question. I don't mind, but it's not a question.
Well, it will be, sir. Just give me a moment. The judgment describes this water treatment, and I quote, "The victim was bound or otherwise secured in a prone position, and water was forced through his mouth and nostrils into his lungs and stomach. One man, Yukio Asano, was sentenced to 15 years at hard labor by the Allies for waterboarding American troops to obtain information. Since Yukio Asano was trying to get information to help defend his country, exactly what you, Mr. Ashcroft, say is acceptable for Americans to do, do you believe his sentence was unjust?"
Now listen here. You're comparing apples and oranges. You're comparing white people and yellow people. You're comparing Americans and barbarians.
No, okay, that's all. No, everything after the apples and oranges part was mine.
You're comparing apples and oranges. Apples and oranges. We don't do anything like what you described.
I'm sorry, I was under the impression that we still use the method of putting a cloth over someone's face and pouring water down their throat. At this point, Ashcroft is red-faced and shouting,
"Pouring! Pouring! Did you hear what she said? Putting a cloth over someone's face and pouring water on them! That's not what you said before! Read that again! What you said before!"
Sir, other reports of the time say...
Read what you said before! Read it!
Mr. Ashcroft, please answer the question.
Read it back!
The victim was bound or otherwise secured in a prone position, and water was forced through his mouth and nostrils into his lungs and stomach.
You hear that? You hear that? Forced. If you can't tell the difference between forcing and pouring, does this college have an anatomy class? If you can't tell the difference between forcing and pouring, why am I itching like this? Why do I feel... What are those bats?
Mr. Ashcroft, do you believe that Yukio Asano's sentence was unjust? Answer the question. It's not a fair question. There's no comparison. Next question. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. What a freak. Elsinora says, my final verdict on Ashcroft. This is what Hannah Arendt meant by the banality of evil. Seems like a normal guy. And yet. The Repiglicans are down to the point of having to hair split between the concept of forcing water and pouring water. I guess John Ashcroft never heard that old saw about how water will seek its own level. If you're pouring it and your mouth is jacked open, and the water keeps pouring, at what point is that not forcing? You know, way more than 2,000 years ago, Aristotle wrote a book. And I gotta tell you, it's some pretty dry reading. Aristotle is not nearly as much fun as reading Plato writing about Socrates. Aristotle's pretty much drier than a snake's belly in a wagon rut. But if you can get through it, Aristotle's book, The Poetics, speaks to this situation. Because he talks about the effect that drama, and for him in particular, tragedy, has on the audience. And for the first time, and pretty much forever, established what are referred to in the theater as the unities. Unities of time, unities of place, unities of action. And he explains why it is that theater does for an audience what it does. Samuel Taylor Coleridge would later go on and expand upon it in the form of what he called the willing suspension of disbelief. But for the most part, Aristotle explains that we have a sort of cleansing when we watch when we watch theater. That we go through a wide range of human emotions, but then when the lights come up, well, not the lights, they didn't have lights back then, when it's all over and all the actors walk off stage, you kind of go, whew, still here. That was some really nasty stuff those folks went through, but I'm still here. And I'm a little bit the better for it because I'm going to think about what the play was trying to say. And if you've ever seen that film, regrettably, with Tom Cruise in it, called A Few Good Men, and you've seen the character played by Jack Nicholson come absolutely unglued on the stand under the Tom Cruise character's cross-examination. You know, unless you're an absolute psychopath, your feeling of victory take place when you see the Nicholson character incriminating himself and standing there and screaming at the courtroom, "You can't handle the truth! I am the watchman on the walls!" And when he incriminates himself, there's a profound sense of relief because you know that justice is going to be done. And like so many, like the earliest Greek tragedies, justice, divine or human, is a central tenet. And so what the weird thing, I don't know. I imagine they've got to still be talking about it on the Knox College campus there in Galesburg, Illinois. Because it wasn't any theater piece that they witnessed in watching John Ashcroft melt down. It wasn't any stage drama or personified tale of the mythic days of old. They saw a former Attorney General of the United States go completely, rabidly, frothing at the mouth, insane. And they saw him incriminate himself. They saw him say enough words that were the Fifth Amendment applicable to him, you would just about have to read him his rights halfway through and say, Mr. Ashcroft, anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. Because John Ashcroft confessed that he is, in fact, not in theory, but in fact, a war criminal. Honest to God. Cross my heart. He had to start screaming about the difference between pouring and forcing. In a way, what this brave woman and the rest of the incredibly brave young students at Knox College did was to get us as close as we will come to justice for war criminals like Ashcroft, like Rice, like Tenet, like Cheney, and Fife, and Edelman, and most importantly of all, George Bush. And that is, as Aristotle noted in the Poetics, incredibly important to the health of what the ancient Greeks called the polis, and from which we take our words politics, politician. Mostly translated as city, hence Annapolis, Indianapolis, Indiana City, Anna City, but which actually means so much more, because the polis is comprised of the people who are actively interested in perpetuating it and participating in it. I don't, apart from simply saying thank you, there's not a lot I can do. If I had a medal I could send to these kids, young adults, Jesus, Bob, I would. Because I am so incredibly proud of them for doing something that the much vaunted United States Congress has lacked the essential guts to do. You heard that hopeless weenie Sestak, who was on Mark Levine's show a couple of days ago. I hope. If you haven't, go get the podcast. You really need it for comparison's sake. This pathetic, spineless, weenie congressman talking about how he was unwilling to see the Congress exercise the power that is explicitly granted to the Congress and no one else. An issue which the Supreme Court itself said in 1935 that it will not engage in, that it will not touch the power to haul Josh Bolten and Harriet Myers before the House of Representatives on a charge of an inherent contempt and to jail those two people until such time as they, by their own volition, purge themselves of their contempt. Because this is a civil contempt in which the ancient axiom is, you know, random legal stuff that John Ashcroft doesn't have time to remember, random legal stuff. It is said that a person held in such contempt holds the keys to his own jail cell. Because all they have to do is comply with the subpoena, and the incarceration ends. But hopeless, lily-livered cowards like Congressman Sestak will not stand up to the thugs and the bully boys of the Bush administration. Not to Ashcroft, not to Mukasey, not to Gonzalez, not to Rice, not to Cheney, not to Rumsfeld, not to no one. Because they live in fear. Because they're the people that Shakespeare was talking about when he said, a coward dies a thousand deaths, a hero dies but once. Now, you and I both know that that's not literal. What Shakespeare was referring to is that in the earth-shaking, knee-knocking fear that a coward lives in, every potential action is a cause for water, bowel-watering terror to strike. So that the coward dies again and again and again and again and again. So that every time a Democrat contemplates impeachment, his guts turn to water and the blood drains out of his face. So that every time the word impeachment is mentioned to Nancy Pelosi, she goes all limp and dead-like with the morbid fear of what those mean, nasty Republicans would do to her dreams of consolidating her power. While off in tiny Galesburg, Illinois, there are heroes who were not afraid to stare John Ashcroft squarely in the eye and make that evil SOB blink. And guess what? He did. He blinked. And he blanched. And he, without even being so much as waterboarded, confessed his manifest crimes. The Congress of the United States would do well to learn from the students of Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois, would do well indeed, because America aches for justice, and we ache for redress of grievances against Ashcroft and against Rumsfeld and against Rice and Fife and Edelman and Wolfowitz and Cheney and Bush and Scalia and Thomas. We ache for justice. Because it seems that justice is so very, very, very far away. We talked about Harriet Myers and Josh Bolton, who were served duly and properly and legal with a subpoena from the House of Representatives, who then looked at the rule of law, and the House of Representatives stuck their thumbs on their noses and waved their four little fingers in the air and went, "Yeah, gotta make me." At which Nancy Pelosi wet herself. Because she knew that the Republicans would call her ugly things, and she can't stand it when they're mean to her. Well, guess what? Turns out that Josh Bolton and Harriet Myers, why, they set a precedent. Former Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel lawyer and active war criminal John Yoo. This is the guy who wrote the legal memos that authorized the torture programs. He's been subpoenaed. And he, like Harriet Myers and Josh Bolton before him, has stuck his little thumb on the end of his nose with his little fingers waving in front of him and gone, "Make me." In a letter to Chairman John Conyers, Yoo's lawyer said that this crooked bastard was, quote, not authorized by the Department of Justice to discuss internal deliberations. Most particularly what he said was, "We have been expressly advised by the Office of Legal Counsel of the United States Department of Justice that Professor Yoo is not authorized to discuss before your committee any specific deliberative communications, including the substance of comments on opinions or policy questions or the confidential pre-decisional advice, recommendations, or other positions taken by individuals or entities of the executive branch." Piss off. And, of course, Nancy Pelosi has gone, "Pissing!" And the heroes are 18 and 19 and 20 and 21 and 22 years old out in Galesburg, Illinois. You know, the poll on the Head On Radio Network homepage, headonradionetwork.com, I believe is still up. It says, do you feel that you are, and I'm paraphrasing here, do you feel that you are represented by your elected representatives? I think I was the first one to vote in the poll, and I voted rarely, and I think rarely is in an absolute unbeatable lead. Go vote if you want to. But you know what? When my elected representatives can't find the stones to actually enforce the rule of law, to actually enforce the rules of their own body, I damn sure don't feel represented. Every one of these lily-livered, yellow-bellied, spineless, weeny Democrats who will not stand up for the rule of law has told us plainly that they care more about their salary, about the best health care coverage that America has to offer, about their pension, about their car, about their lobbyist lunches, than they do about the Constitution that they took an oath to uphold. And it makes it real easy to say, throw them all out. But not this time. Not this year. But 2 years from now, run primary opposition to them. We don't get any help when Republicans have the majority in Congress. That's a step backwards. 2 years from now, scare them. Scare them to pieces. Run primary opponents against them. Run yourself. What the hell? It's probably even a provision for waiving the filing fee if you're broke enough. But make them explain. Make them explain why they're so gutless. Make them explain why they will not live up to their oath, taken not to any imaginary, invisible god, but an oath taken to the Constitution of the United States. Why won't you drag, if need be, a war criminal like John Yoo before you and compel his attendance, even if all he does is say, "Hello, my name is John Y. And upon advice of my counsel, I decline to answer any further questions." Make him do it. Let America, for the love of God, at least see them run away from their own crimes. John Conyers has also invited John Ashcroft, George Tenet, Daniel Levin, Doug Feith, and David Addington. Forgot about Addington. To testify. Guess what? They ain't coming. Okay? They're not coming. Gonna be a long way to November. And the saddest thing is that I don't know if getting to November makes any blessed difference. You think strength in numbers will help? That if they finally get a big enough majority by some arbitrary measure of their own, that they'll start acting like they've got some life in them? I honestly don't know. Be interested to see what you think. Now, I love it when I say it here and it comes out there. It turns out that Think Progress, bless their hearts, has started turning up the heat a little bit on John Hagee and John McCain's all-too-cozy relationship. You know, if we're going to make Barack Obama answer for something that Jeremiah Wright said, which, as it turns out, by the way, I found out today, Jeremiah Wright didn't even actually say, he was quoting someone else, a white guy, by the way. If we're going to do that for Barack Obama, for God's sakes, it's only fair to do it with John McCain. By the way, you know what pisses me off? Here's what, oh, God, I went to my MySpace page today. You know what the banner is running at the top of my MySpace page? The courage, the determination, the leadership in a time of need. John McCain for president. seems like every day is just a struggle to keep my fist out of the monitor. You know what I mean? So Think Progress has turned up the heat on McCain. People like me, others on the horn, our buddy Malloy, have been talking about McCain's relationship with Pascal Hager. And after noting that Pastor Hagee reiterated that Katrina struck New Orleans over a homosexual rally, it looks like it finally dawned on the professional media to start asking McCain a few questions about it. Here's the audio of a little compilation of McCain trying to deal with the fact that he really needs Hagee to tell the weird little evangelicals to vote for him, but he doesn't want to put off the normal as close to normal as any pig licking can get. At the same time, it's actually quite cute.
He had to answer for one of his decisions too. In February, he accepted the endorsement of evangelical pastor John Hagee, who has repeatedly claimed Katrina was God's punishment for the sinful behavior of people in New Orleans. Today, McCain did not reject the Hagee endorsement, but denounced the pastor's words.
It's nonsense. It's nonsense, and I don't have anything additional to say about it. It's nonsense. It's nonsense, and I don't have anything more to say about it.
McCain tried to distance himself from Hagee while also taking a subtle swipe at Barack Obama.
I didn't attend Pastor Hagee's church for 20 years. There's a great deal of difference, in my view, between someone who endorses you and other circumstances.
Charming, John. What a nice little dig. All the people who have spent 20 or 30 years in churches are just going to love that one. In other words, you didn't attend Pastor Hagee's church. You just want to use Pastor Hagee like a John uses a hooker. Right? Right.
His carefully scripted imagery was interrupted by a voter's question about Pastor John Hagee, who endorsed McCain and says things like this.
What happened in New Orleans looked like the curse of God.
When someone endorses me, that does not mean that I embrace their views.
And on his bus, a dig at Barack Obama.
I didn't attend Pastor Hagee's church for 20 years. There's a great deal of difference, in my view, between someone who endorses you and other circumstances.
And that despite McCain's pledge to run an above-the-fray campaign.
Above the fray campaign. My left hind foot. They're repiglickins. They don't know where the fray is to get above it. They don't know where the fray is, the fringe is. The only thing they know is that wherever they are is where everything they've got only falls down on the rest of us plebs in trickles. Lord, I despise them. But maybe people will start tormenting John McCain with Pastor Hagee the way that Barack Obama has been beset with the more or less reasonable words, which, by the way, were, as I noted, were not his own, of Pastor Wright. And America looks to Galesburg, Illinois. Tiny Galesburg, Illinois. For a hero. This is The Horn. We'll be back.
Dolphins
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Bob.
So the actions of the high and mighty have influences and effects that do, in fact, trickle down to the rest of us. I'm Bob, by the way. I'm so incredibly comfortable in all of this and with all of you that I neglect to note from time to time that there are new listeners every day. The numbers bear that out. I'm Bob. This is The Horn. We produce more live, liberal, progressive, uncompromised, uncorporatized, uncontrolled liberal conversation in a day than anybody else in America. We do it via listener partnership because you guys decide that it's worth having and you contribute to keep us on the air. We try to raise about $2,000 a month. April is growing old. And we are still about $500 and change from making our monthly requirement. And we're still in a hole, by the way. We're in a hole that's about not counting the $500 and change we need to
get us through April, we're in a hole that's about $2,000 deep. And that is a, shall we say, conservative estimate. Got an email today asking me, could I please try to do something about equalizing my volume with that of the callers? And I do what I can. I produce this myself. We don't have a team of well-paid technical staffers who sit here and somebody answers the phone and somebody runs the board and somebody manages the EQ on the phones and all. No. We are just like you. We're working people. So I manage the phones on my own here, and I do what I can to tweak call levels and stuff. But the fact of the matter is, we have an incredibly expensive telephone processor unit that for months now has needed to go into the shop. But the repair bill on that alone will be somewhere between probably $600 and $850. And it can't go until we've got the ability to get it fixed. So that's part and parcel of the answer to the question that was put to me today. I will try to ride a little closer herd on call volumes and things like that to the extent humanly possible. Because this is, after all, a digital signal you're receiving, and it is a far higher quality signal than you get coming out of a crackly old AM radio where most talk resides. In fact, most liberal talk, as opposed to being on the 50,000-watt blowtorches of America, the WSBs, the WLWs, the WSMs, and so forth, instead of being on those blowtorches, the liberals are relegated to the flickering candle flame where you sort of have to stand on one leg and put your hand in the air and stick your tongue out and hold it this so. To get, or, you know, maybe put an old piece of aluminum foil on the antenna to try to get the signal, especially at nighttime. God, I remember my last foray into terrestrial radio, censored radio. 5,000 watts in the day, 25 watts at night. And that's just what you're dealing with when you're dealing with regulated radio that is not... That's not free like what we have here. But anyway, that's the answer to that question. There's a lot of stuff we need to do. Obviously, based on what I said at the beginning of the program, I'm probably going to have to be going out and searching for yet another video card. Yay! But it would be nice to get the monkey off our back, so to speak, for the month of April, if at all possible. If you have never contributed to the Horn, we would certainly appreciate it if you would consider doing so. If, in fact, you think it's worth having. If you think having a voice that doesn't answer to any corporate paymaster is worth having. If you think having a voice, your voice, out there, showing others that it's okay to talk liberal values, progressive ideas, and not be shut down, and not only have 2.5 minutes, but all the time in the world that you need to get your idea across, then maybe we're worth supporting to you. Because that is the one thing that we promise that no one else can deliver but the Horn, and that is untrammeled, uncensored conversation radio. So that's that. But no, what I said earlier, you know, that remark by Ashcroft that no one has the right to force their religious views on anybody else, and that no one has the right to disrespect anyone else's religious views, horse hockey to that last, I say. Or do I? Pair of stories here. One, going back to yesterday, from WBIR, Knoxville, Tennessee, a public high school student's refusal to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance got her booted from class in Hamilton County, Tennessee. The school is called Tyner Academy. I'm guessing that means it's not a public school. When you're down south, and those of you who are not familiar with the South might not know this, that's why I'm here. Back when Brown versus Board of Education was decided by the Supreme Court, all the terrified white people, or a lot of them, and their churches founded Christian schools. And most of the time, they had the word academy on the end of the name of the school. And what a perversion that is of the original of that word. I was talking about Aristotle earlier. Well, his teacher was Plato, who was taught by Socrates, and Plato opened the original academy. And Lord God, the academy in Athens lasted for centuries until it was eventually shut down by the Christians, because it was teaching entirely too much thinking. But all of these white terror, white flight schools like to hang academy on the end of their on the end of their name, because they felt it gave them some sort of legitimacy. So, hence Tyner Academy, which I'm guessing is some sort of church affiliated, based on what happened here, some sort of church affiliated goon squad, phony intellectual institution. 18-year-old Tyner Academy senior Quinesha Garrett got yanked from school this week, from the daytime classes, that is, and was ordered to attend school at night, where they don't recite the Pledge of Allegiance. That's right. She wouldn't stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, and she got thrown out of class. That is the America that we live in these, the waning years of the first decade of the 21st century. Not going boldly forward into a hopeful future, but desperately shirking backward into a fascist nightmare. Quinesha Garrett wouldn't stand for the pledge, and they yanked her out of class. But the story has a happy ending, because Quinesha got hold of a lawyer, and the lawyer called the school, and there the officials at Tyner Academy said, "Why, Quinesha, come on back here to school, honey. That's fine. What's that? You wasn't standing for the pledge because of your devout Christian beliefs? Well, come on in, honey. Long as you wasn't standing for the pledge because your God, your imaginary cloud critter, tells you not to, that'll be just fine, baby. You just come on back here now." You see, for a while there, they thought that she was doing some of that unholy protesting. They thought that maybe she was a liberal, or one of them liberals that won't call themselves a liberal and instead says that they're progressive. They thought she might be a war protester, that she was somehow manifesting her un-Americanism by not standing for the good and godly holy pledge of allegiance. That'll get you thrown out of school. But once you tell them you're a Christian and that you're not allowed to pledge allegiance to anything but God, why, they open the doors up and say, "Come right in, baby. Sit right down. Here, let us tell you about them 5,000-year-old dinosaurs. You just open the book right up there. Do you know that, honey? Do you know that? Do you know that the world is only 5,000 years old?" That's right. That's right. "The earth is younger than the recipe for bread." That's right.
we're so proud that you're not standing for the pledge because you're such a Christian. It just makes our little hearts go pitter-pat. Let this be a lesson to the rest of you. If there's anybody here who doesn't think that our war against them brown people in Iraq and the nuclear holocaust that we is going to open up on them, that nuclear can of whoop-ass that we're going to open on the people of Iran isn't nothing but sanctioned by God, don't you be manifesting that by not standing up for the pledge now. The pledge of allegiance is sacred because the flag is holy. Hallelujah. Praise God. Really. I mean, you know, that's what it was. No, the lawyer said that once the school administrators became aware of Garrett's reason, they nullified the transfer to the night school. And administrators, well, they declined to comment. Because she was refusing to stand up for anything but Christ Jesus. And that's precious in the sight of the Lord. Meanwhile, we travel not too awfully far from Knoxville, Tennessee, over to North Buncombe, North Carolina. Now, over in North Buncombe, North Carolina, there's a young man by the name of Brian Killian. Brian Killian says that he, and I believe him, is a Pastafarian. Brian Killian, Ramen, is a follower of the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. Now, we've talked about the Holy Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster from time to time here, and you all know that a central tenet of the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster is that one of the reasons we have global warming is because there are not enough pirates on Earth. That's no less crazy than saying that the Earth is only 5,000 years old. And moreover, we have the very words of John Ashcroft that no one in America has the right to disrespect anyone on account of their religion. Unless, of course, you're a member of the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. And Brian Killian, as a function, you know, just like people of one faith who have to wear little hats to school, or people of another faith who have to wear a big old cross around their neck, Brian Killian feels it is his religious duty to go to school dressed as a pirate. Ramen. And so he showed up in his little homemade pirate costume. And the authorities at his school in North Buncombe threw him out. Yes, sirree. Threw him right out of school. Said he was being disruptive. His pirate garb was disruptive. Now, bear in mind, it wasn't like he had a sword with him. I mean, the Sikhs who follow the 10th Guru,
they have to carry a ceremonial knife with them everywhere. And they're so terrifying to the Secret Service that they wouldn't let the Sikhs in on a meeting with the old Hitler Youth anti-aircraft gunner, Benedict the 16th. Or maybe it was George Bush. I have such a hard time keeping my Nazi enablers separated. But Brian Killian wasn't even carrying a sword. He had a hand-drawn picture of a sword on paper tucked into his pirate sash around his waistband. Mm-hmm. And the school in North Buncombe, North Carolina, remains fervent in their determination that they were right to suspend young Brian Killian for a day, and they say that it didn't have nothing to do with his religion and everything to do with his repeated refusal to heed warnings against wearing pirate outfits. But that's the problem. The pirate outfit is a part of his religion. Why won't the administrators at North Buncombe High School give Brian Killian his God-given, remember, America was founded on a gift of freedom by God. That's what George Bush said. And Brian Killian's manifestation of God is the flying spaghetti monster. They won't give him his religious due. I hate that we Pastafarians are so persecuted. It's just sad. It's tragic, even. Young man wants to please his God. His God says that global warming needs to be addressed and that we can cut down on global warming by having more pirates in the world. It's just sad. We all know that first he made a tree and a mountain and a dwarf. And then he made us, touching us with his noodly appendage. And that he is everywhere, the flying spaghetti monster. And everything that happens, happens because the flying spaghetti monster wanted it to do so. But still, all over North Buncombe High School, there's children walking around with hunks of jewelry hanging around their necks that are a representation of a torture device from 2,000 years ago. And that's all right. That's not disruptive. While they wear them on their shirts, sometimes they wear T-shirts, telling the world that Christ is the King. But one nonviolent, peacefully spirited young man wants to show up and do homage to his God, the flying spaghetti monster, by dressing as his God tells him he must do, just like some people have to wear little hats and other people have to wear hardware. And he's the one who's disruptive. You know what? I hope Brian Killian sues these bastards. I really, really do. Maybe then we can finally realize that pirate costumes and hardware and hats and scarves have absolutely nothing to do with the learning process.
Maybe Brian Killian can pay for college while he's at it. That'd be nice. But it's just a shame that North Buncombe High School can't treat Brian Killian with the same deference that it treated the young lady at Tyner Academy. What do you reckon they'd do to Brian Killian if he refused to stand for the pledge because he was being religiously oppressed? Don't know who Brian Killian's parents are, but I sure hope they're standing with their son, because they've done a pretty good job so far, and their son's got more guts than most of the cross-wearers, all of the cross-wearers, in that incredibly benighted school. More guts than the principal, more guts than the whole administration. We seem to have developed a theme tonight, haven't we? It would look like our theme tonight is the bravery of young people, the heroism of young people. High school's a brutal place. God only knows the things that were hollered at young Brian Killian for showing up in his little homemade pirate costume. But he stood on his principle. Well, no, he didn't stand on his principle. That would be a different crime. He stood on his principles. L-E-S, not A-L-S. And I admire him for it. So we slide then down to South Carolina for something that is much more disturbing. The story of an 18-year-old in Chesterfield, South Carolina. 18-year-old Ryan Schallenberger, who, his neighbors say, wouldn't hurt a flea. People just don't know him like I do. He's a good kid. But something, a few days back, caused Ryan Schallenberger to bang his head into the wall so hard that he dented the wall board. And his parents called mental health authorities, who declined to have anything to do with him. A few days later, his parents got quite a shock when 10 pounds of ammonium nitrate showed up at their doorstep, having been ordered by young Ryan on eBay. Ryan Schallenberger's parents got quite nervous. Ryan Schallenberger's parents dropped the dime on young Ryan to the local constabulary. The local law enforcement authorities went into full-on hissy mode and descended upon Ryan's home and searched it high and low. And they found what they claim was a journal praising the perpetrators of the Columbine massacre and full-scale plans to bomb his school. And they've charged him with terrorist threats. And they've charged him with possession of bomb-making material. They've charged him with being a terrorist.
The Chesterfield County Sheriff, Sam Parker, told ABC this past Tuesday, "We applaud these parents, and we're very thankful they chose to be concerned, and they chose to get involved. We feel like they saved a lot of life in our county." His mother and his stepfather are heartbroken. The sheriff said, "They were very concerned about his future education. I kindly explained to them, and I told them we got to deal with two options here. We got to deal with his education or with his life." Sheriff Sam Parker, he was right. Because 18-year-old Ryan Schallenberger, it has been confirmed by the United States Attorney for that district of South Carolina, he has confirmed that he will seek an indictment of Ryan Schallenberger of attempting to use a weapon of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. The potential penalty for that charge for this 18-year-old young man is life in prison. Life in prison. Life in a federal lockup next door to Ted Kaczynski. I wish I was kidding. I'm not. Not at all. The young man didn't go around school making threats. Students said Schallenberger often ate alone in the cafeteria. James Ford, a 16-year-old sophomore, said, "I never thought he'd be the dude to do something like this." He's a straight-A student. His mother and stepfather, John and Lori Sitley, have not offered up any comment. Neither have any of young Ryan Schallenberger's 8 siblings and step-siblings. No one has any explanation for anything, except the fact that acting U.S. Attorney Kevin McDonald says that Schallenberger will face 2 other lesser federal charges stemming from his scheme to detonate explosives in a suicide attack at his high school. Based upon the seized journal and the stuff that he had around his house. Might he have been another Columbine monster? It's entirely possible. But here's the punchline, if you will. You know, I get these right-wing blast emails from the American Family Association. I got one yesterday that said, subject line, "If you could afford it, would you take your cheering out of public schools?" Because, you see, the American Family Association has been on the full-bore attack against the idea of public taxpayer-funded schooling for years now. "Dear Bob, did you read the Associated Press story about Ryan Schallenberger in Chesterfield, South Carolina? Authorities learned of the student's plans to commit mass murder at his school. Police discovered a hate-filled journal lauding the Columbine High School killers. An audio tape to be played after he perished during his rampage. And a year's worth of plans for the bombing that included a hand-drawn map of the school. Prosecutor Jay Hodgdon said the kid had the intellect and the means and the materials to carry it out.
It is time for parents to pull their cheering out of the public schools. And you have to go way down deep into the story of Ryan Schallenberger to find out that he had 8 siblings and step-siblings. Not a mention in this story of the fundamentalism of the parents. But you know what? You can almost infer it from the number of siblings and step-siblings. Young bombers are made, not born. And he tried to drive his head through a wall, this straight-A high school senior. And the American Family Association sees that as evidence of our growing sickness in our secular humanist society. When any journalistic effort whatsoever could find out, probably, that Mr. and Mrs. Sitley, his mother and stepfather, are fundies. Just like Timothy McVeigh. Just like David Koresh. Just like Jerry Falwell. Just like Robertson, Dobson. Just like James Robison and Oral Roberts. Deadly killer fundies. To the phones. Hi, who have I got?
You got Ben here.
Hey, Ben, what's up, brother?
Weapon of mass destruction, man. You know, I mean, talk about cheapening terms.
Yeah, it kind of does, doesn't it?
A weapon of mass destruction is what we did to what the United States government did to Hiroshima. That's what we did to Nagasaki. That's what we did to that's what we did to Cologne. You know?
That's what we did to Fallujah.
Yeah, well, pretty much. Because it wasn't quite the orchestrated firestorm attack I'm thinking of. You know, where you absolutely
Dresden
have dropped you at Dresden, exactly.
The firebombing of Tokyo.
Exactly. You know, that's a weapon of mass destruction. If I cross anthrax and leprosy and the flu and release that in a population, that's a weapon of mass destruction. If I have a tanker truckload of nerve gas and I let it go in New York, that's a weapon of mass destruction. But 10 pounds of Anfo, man, I've made bigger bombs than that.
Ben, you're not helping.
Hey, you know, I worked the summer for a guy who blasted stumps and things.
Yeah, and frankly, a Ryder truck filled to bursting with ammonium nitrate and diesel fuel?
Very different. Very different from a 10-pound bomb. No, I'm not saying that disturbed young men have 10-pound bombs. I mean, you know,
No.
A pound of that in one place, I was scared of it.
But he stands to, dig it, he stands to get the same life sentence as Ted Kaczynski, who actually killed people.
Right. This is ridiculous. You know, yes, he's a disturbed young man. Yes, he was, you know, attempting to manufacture an infernal device. But, you know, there was already a law about manufacturing infernal devices.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, BATF already had that one covered long, long, long ago. That's why the guy I worked for had to have a license to do this.
But the thing is, there's nothing in here to indicate, Ben, that he manufactured anything. He had some components laying around.
He had components, and if he had a clear plan that said he was going to do it, you can infer the action for all those things. And, you know, obtaining components with a plan is colorably manufactured.
It's kind of like a conspiracy of one.
Right, right. You know, I mean, I can understand that. Bring them up on that charge. But it isn't a bloody weapon of mass destruction. It isn't even close. My God, are we the most ridiculous country there has ever been in the face of the planet? People have to laugh at us.
That's why I call us the coward nation.
This is like reading those old science newsletters, you know, science magazines, or those old Soviet magazines from the Stalin era and from Lenin's time, where they're trumpeting Soviet achievements, and all you can do, even at the time, people laughed at them. You know, I mean, look at the joke Chekhov on Star Trek. The joke always there in the original series was, you know, the Russians did it first. And it was always a joke because we all know the Russians claim to have done everything first.
Right.
Because they actually operated on a very similar system of epistemology to this present government in this country. And that is, if we wish it hard enough, if we say it hard enough, if we pass our laws, it's bloody true.
But you know what? There is an upside to this, Ben. Thanks to the further relaxation of the enlistment rules to the United States military, even if this young man gets convicted, he's still eligible to join the Army.
Well, you know what? Back when I was a kid, if you had a disturbed young man like this, and you were a sitting federal judge, and you looked that he had no record before this, and you thought he needed just some straightening out, you'd tell him, young man, I'm going to let you walk out of here and into the hands of the Marine recruiter right there in the back row. And if you do that, I'm not going to sentence you today.
I know people that have had that happen to them.
And you know what? It usually worked.
Yeah. Yeah, it usually did. But this is life? Life, Ben?
This is out of proportion. This is what cruel and unusual punishment actually means. Punishment out of all proportion to the offense is a cruel punishment.
Not anymore. Not thanks to Justice Scalia and company.
I hope to see all of them up for life or worse.
It would be gratifying. It would be incredibly gratifying. But, you know, the thing is, it's always a matter of the journalism that isn't there in the story. And I guess maybe Shauna Adcox, who wrote this story, I guess it didn't occur to her to wonder, because most people don't. Sometimes I feel, you know, between the folks on the Horn and Malloy, I feel like we're the only ones who ask why there's always a fundamentalist connection to these people with the urge to commit slaughter in America.
I'll tell you why. Because they worship somebody hung up on a tree. You know, I'm about as atheist as you can get. Okay, I don't believe there is a flying spaghetti monster, and I don't care how many pirates you show me.
Okay, so you're a spagnostic.
I'm a spagnostic.
Okay.
And you know what? I think we need to change the Constitution. We need to change that First Amendment just slightly, and change it to freedom from religion.
You know, John Fox has mentioned the fact that they have that in the Australian Constitution, and I really like it.
Well, you know what? The Aussies had a few years on us and got to see what we made the mistakes with. And one of them was that, and the other was how we vote.
Yeah.
And maybe we ought to pay attention to how they do things down there just this once.
Yeah, just once. Good luck. But
anyhow, that's all. I get back to my work here and worrying about my brother, who's going to be put out of his house now.
Oh, Jesus, I saw that email, Ben. That's awful.
Yeah. Carpenter. Worked all his life. Now he can't find any work as a carpenter. He's working 72 hours a week in three jobs, and he can't pay his mortgage. And it sucks, man.
Yeah, I know it does. And just remember, yeah. George Bush says it's uniquely American.
Yeah, I want to show him something uniquely American. It's called a chain gang.
I know.
Well, take care, my friend.
Give your brother our best regards, please. Tell him we're thinking of him. See you, Ben.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Onward. Hi, who have I got?
Well, Bob, you got Dave up here in Northern.
Well, hey, Dave.
And I am not yet sure what a spagnostic is, but somehow I suspect...
A spagnostic is someone who does not believe in the flying spaghetti monster.
Oh, I see, yes. Oh, well, that I haven't really delved into enough to be able to say intelligently yet, but your program tonight brought to mind to me an act of heroism that occurred at the other age of the age spectrum. other end of it.
Okay.
And it happened about 50 years ago, and I think perhaps you're already quite familiar with it, and if not, I'll try to fill in what I might know of little gaps in there, and that is Pope Pius XII, who had been something of a neocon, corporatist-powered person, died about 50 years ago, and factions within the church were debating, trying to come up with... There was a left and a right in the church, and both of them were strong enough that they could hold their own, but neither side was going to cave enough that they would be able to elect either a conservative or a liberal. And so they made a decision. They would compromise. They would elect a jovial old, happy, good-natured fellow who spoke a number of languages. He was the Archbishop of Turkey, named Giuseppe Roncalli. And he said, I will be called Pope John.
Yeah, John the 23rd.
John the 23rd, and I don't have an awful lot of heroes among the papacy, but I do have one, and this is one. This is him. Right from the beginning, day one, he set his old cardinals down and explained that he had just inherited a very, very sick church, and he was an old man, so they were going to have to move fast because he didn't have a lot of time. So everything that had been going on for almost a couple thousand years, like at one point during the coronation, they'd bring in this big, humongous crown with all kinds of rubies and diamonds and jades in it. I think it's 70 pounds or something. They would set it on his head, and he said, no, 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 take that away. The skull cap will be more than enough. Boom, 1,800 years of tradition down the tube. And at one point in the coronation, all the old cardinals had to lay down on their stomach and crawl up on their elbows and kiss the feet of the new pope. And he said, no, no, gentlemen, remain seated. There will be no more of that kind of craziness. So he'd already started out what was going to be reform after reform after reform. He said to the cardinals, I am going to call a Vatican II. And this means he's going to, what, speak ex cathedra. This means the no bull bull. What I say now, you have to believe if you call yourself a Catholic. You know what he said?
What's that?
He issued a proclamation on religious liberty. After they'd gone through all the holy oils and the incense and everything and put him on the right throne, he now spoke ex cathedra, and he said, where your conscience may take you to differ with your church, your creed, that you may be committed to, it shall not only be your right, it shall be your obligation to go with your conscience, to go with your own thinking, and not the teachings of your church. Well, at that moment, a number of old bishops and cardinals turned purple, and some turned white, and most of them were gasping for air. Did he just say what I thought he said? You know, that is he going to just take away all of our powers and our ability to tell the people how to think? He just did it. In a matter of a minute, he had taken a Stone Age religion into the avant-garde. And some of the old cardinals flying back from that Vatican II, well, Francis Spellman, probably the worst of them, he said, not a word of that old damn fool will reach North America. And for the most part, he blocked it. Even good people like yourself may or may not have gotten all this story before, because he blocked it. It wasn't going to happen, though. What came to us came secondhand out of Europe and Africa, other places where there were had some freedom to speak.
And of course, the United States is, by virtue of people like Antonin Scalia and Mel Gibson and a few others, a hotbed of resistance to Vatican II. Vatican II eliminated the need for Latin masses, which, you know, while, you know, kind of nice on Christmas and Easter, it's actually, you know, I don't know, I'm not a Roman Catholic, so I can't speak to it, but I'd actually like to have the priest speak my language. And these people, these pre-Vatican II people, are absolutely poisonous, Dave. 20 million dollars that Mel Gibson dumped into his weirdo church out in Malibu. You know, and at the same time, you know, what John the 23rd was also resistant to Opus Dei.
It goes without saying that the Pope should have followed John the 23rd, and he lasted longer than I thought. I think he was good for 7 or 8 years, but after him, Pope Paul, reasonably good guy, but he tried to undo what he could of what John the 23rd had done. Then there was a Pope John Paul I, who was going to be a bigger reformer than John ever thought of being.
And frankly, he was a student of John the 23rd.
Yes, he was, and a most progressive man, and he was sent to bed one night with a cup of tea, never to rise again.
Exactly. This was also a man who, during the reign of Paul, had militated. It was either Pius or Paul. He militated for the excommunication of Adolf Hitler, and he was rat slapped for it.
Yes, Pius the 11th and 12th were both quite sympathetic to Adolf.
John Paul II gets in and begins fervently working to, one, stack the deck in the College of Cardinals. He squashed the liberation theology movement of Latin America like a bug.
He put in power Benedict, the current pope, who would go on to become Benedict. So, yes, an awful lot of what seemed to have been a moment of hope, a moment of, Camelot in the Catholic Church, was seen as gradually, well, I guess as rapidly as they could, undone.
This is pretty fast work in terms of the rather glacial qualities of papal action. But they've moved very, very quickly. I mean, this... it was Pope John Paul II who elevated Opus Dei to, and it was unheard of, a papal prelature, so that no bishop in the country, in the world, has any authority over Opus Dei whatsoever, and Opus Dei answers only to the papacy. And again, elevated the founder of Opus Dei to sainthood, who said, quote, "The world was too hard on Adolf Hitler. He couldn't possibly have killed 6 million Jews. It couldn't have been more than 4 million.
Well, that makes it a whole lot less abusive,
Well, I see that in the same light as that Stalinist quote about 20 people dead was it Stalinist or was it a Nazi? I can't remember. 20 people dead is a tragedy. 20,000 dead, it's a statistic.
Well, I love your program. Thank you for being there, Bob. And I have a tech coming that's going to try to help get me back on the chat room. For some reason, I have been blocked out. Not everybody agrees with the things that we mutter.
I understand that, but odds are, if it's anything like the technical nightmares that we go through here, for instance, I'm afraid to get within a foot of the computer that's running the broadcast right now, because if I so much as make it wiggle, everything will go off the air. Technical nightmares, one after the other. So I wish you well, and I'm sure we'll see you in the chat room again soon, Dave.
I hope so, Bob. But do be suspicious. I say my advice to you, do be suspicious.
I am, and we've talked about it at great length. Our IT professional and the world's most fabulous conversation radio host, Peter Godbold, a year ago or more, identified these Department of Defense packets that were coming at his computer. Coming through, I think it was Halliburton packets. And this isn't paranoia. These are identifiable, and they're stealth things, and not even the very best anti-spyware, anti-virus programming even identifies them. No.
When I was a regular on Mark Levine's Radio Inside Scoop blog, we had some of the most obnoxious neocons there with us, taking us on, and one was just particularly abusive. Mark has the ability to track these people to their source, and would you believe the most obnoxious of them all was posting from his FBI ISP?
Not at all surprising.
Clue as to where that guy was coming.
We've identified listeners at the NSA.
Yeah.
That's why we've started making the generic reference to Agent Fred. By the way, Dave, ELO in the chat room wants to know if you got her email.
I haven't yet, but I'll go check. Maybe.
Well, she says if you haven't, that she'll resend it as well.
Thank you so much, and thank your ELO for all that she does.
I sure will. Dave, take care. Glad to hear from you, brother.
Thank you, Bob.
Bye now. Her pal Dave in Northern California. Wow. What a night. Covered a lot of ground, didn't we? Sometimes it's good to do that. We covered a lot of ground, and yet I'm sitting here looking at probably 18 other stories I didn't even touch. One of these days, we're going to have to figure out how to get it all in. But one of the ways that we do get it all in is via the horn section, which comes your way at 11 p.m. Eastern Time, right after the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio program, Strictly Confidential, which is on its way with your host, Peter Godbold, and a guest that I think you will find quite enjoyable and fascinating this evening. Following the horn section, of course, the Friday night edition. Yeah, I know it's Thursday, but it's his Friday, okay? The Friday night edition of All Foxed Up, all the way through the miracle of the internets from Sydney, Australia, via the studios here in wild, wonderful West by God, Virginia. Speaking of West Virginia, our eternal thanks go out, as every evening, to some of the most hardworking and absolutely the bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, who sponsor in part all the broadcasts on the Head On Radio Network. You can go to crmw.net. You can join for next to nothing. And you can become a part of the solution that may even save lives. Not may, will save lives. When we bring an end, and we will bring an end, to mountaintop removal. Many thanks, of course, to John Fox and Peter Godbold, respectively, our chief engineer and our IT professional. Many thanks to Ben Birch, the hardest working man in liberal talk, who almost single-handedly saved liberal talk at whiterosesociety.org. He's raising funds. He needs your help. We at the Horn need your help. We're trying to get to our monthly goal, and we seem to be getting there. It got off to a roaring good start, and then it slowed considerably. If you haven't participated, if you haven't contributed to keeping the Horn on the air, and you are able to do so, that's important, if you're able to do so, we would appreciate your contribution at the PayPal button on the website, headonradionetwork.com, or via snail mail to 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, West Virginia, 25801. By the way, we've got a new ad up from moveon.org on the website. It would do us all a great deal of honor and help if you would just go to the website and click the dickens out of that thing and let them see that advertising on the headonradionetwork.com website is worth their effort. Of course, also at the website is the chat room, free, and the forum, also free. Every means that we can make available for you to share your opinions, your thoughts, what it means to be liberal, what it means to be progressive, what it means to be truly American, we try to make available. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you. We'll be right back.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 135 of Strictly Confidential. My name is Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio exclusively right here on listener-supported Head On Radio Network, also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch. That's crmw.net, Coal River Mountain Watch. Stop by Coal River Mountain Watch and have a look and see what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Thursday, April 24th, 2008. So, indeed, if you are listening on a Thursday evening, April 24, 08, shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time, you're indeed listening to a live show, and you are more than welcome to call in and participate with myself and with the guest whom I'll be introducing shortly. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4, head-on. That's 877-4-HEAD-ON. If you have unlimited long distance, please use that. You'll save the studio a nickel or a buck. That's area code 304-658-3333, and that rings in West Virginia, 304-658-3333. 3333. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests and to the audio archives from past shows, as well as our chat room, which is active as I speak, and a good evening to stop by. You'll find links at strictlyconfidentialradio.com to the main Head On Radio Network main site. You can find out about all of the other progressive programming on this network, of which I'm only a small part. There are links there also for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. And welcome to a Thursday evening edition of Strictly Confidential. Tonight is a music night. We have an amazing man brought to us by our Director of Music Talent, Mr. Glenn Rivera. Glenn doesn't know of his title. He was just awarded it. Glenn, that's the title. You are now officially the Director of Music Talent. Welcome aboard. And thank you for bringing so many talented artists to this show. This evening's guest is Manny Parrish. He's more commonly known as Man Parrish. Man is considered to be a pioneer of electronic music in the hip-hop genres. And he, along with artists such as Kraftwerk, Art of Noise, Africa Bambaataa, helped create and define the sound of hip-hop in the early 80s. He was an underground music scene icon in the 80s and 90s.